Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Hello and welcome to an episode of Space Talks, a science-based show with a particular interest in all things space. This is Stephen Lowry along with co-host Tim Woods, who's usually on Vancouver Island, but today is in the studio here in downtown Salmon Arm. Hello Tim, tell us of today's topic.
The first topic is how exciting it is to be here in the studio right with you and record this together. But the topic we are going to look at today is Neptune, the eighth planet from the Sun, and some might argue the last planet if you're inclined against classifying Pluto as a planet. Steve, we've got our work cut out for us when it comes to talking about this particular planet. There's only been one spacecraft to actually visit the planet, and that was Voyager 2, way back in 1989. Now, the planet is about 30 AUs from the Earth, or 30 times as far as the Earth is from the Sun. So it's a long way, and so we've got our challenge and our work cut out for us. First, though, do we have any updates to share?
In an earlier episode, we talked about the Japanese moon lander, which was launched aboard a SpaceX ship, the Falcon, and it took a very low trajectory course to the moon. It took 3 months. And then somehow, just at the very end, when it was approaching a soft landing, it was lost. It was a software glitch which caused the spacecraft to slow down to almost zero, but unfortunately, it was 3 kilometers above the planet. And so gravity overtook it and it accelerated and hit with a force of 500 kilometers per hour. Now, Tim, as you mentioned at the top, the only spacecraft to visit Neptune was Voyager 2, which arrived at the Blue Planet in 1989, 12 years after being launched in 1977. So if you do the math on that one, a fairly speedy one-way trip takes 12 years, and depending on alignments, it might even take longer than that. Voyager 2 would dust the top of the planet, a relatively scant 5,000 kilometers from the cloud tops, and during its flyby, Voyager 2 discovered several new moons, taking detailed images of the planet's atmosphere, its rings, and measured the planet's magnetic field.
Okay, Steve, so we're focusing on Neptune. But there is time for another update, and that's, well, what's happening to Voyager 2 these days?
Well, it's incredibly too, but the news about Voyager 2 is that it just keeps on going. It's been operating for nearly 46 years. We're still in touch with the spacecraft, despite it now being some 133 AUs from Earth. That means 133 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And we have to talk about its power source.
Okay, so I know that the batteries in my remote controllers and phones, well, they need to be either recharged or replaced, but Voyager is too far away to get sufficient light from our sun for solar cells to work. So after all these years, just how does it work?
Well, as mentioned or alluded to in a previous episode, the Voyager 2 spacecraft is powered by 3 radioisotope thermoelectric generators, or RTGs, which use the heat produced by the natural radioactive decay of plutonium-238 to generate electricity. So Voyager 2 contains 33 kilograms of plutonium dioxide, a radioactive isotope with a half-life of about 87 and a half years. Collectively, those 3 RTGs supplied the spacecraft with some 470 watts at the time of launch, back in 1977, and that amount halves every 87 and a half years. And it's predicted to allow the instruments to operate until at least 2020, which it's done. And in April of this year, April 2023, JPL, the Jet Propulsion Lab, began using a reservoir of backup power intended for an onboard safety mechanism. As a result, all 5 instruments are expected to continue operation through to 2026. And when its power eventually fails, the spacecraft Voyager 2 will continue according to Newton's first law of motion, in that it will continue in a straight line until some external force acts upon it. In essence, it will travel forever.
Incredible. I was curious as to whether we're getting any more data from Voyager 2. I mean, it's been a long time since I could recall hearing about any images that had been sent back. And in fact, I'm pretty sure I remember hearing that they'd turned off that aspect of the spacecraft systems just after leaving Neptune to conserve energy, for the very simple reason there wasn't much to take a picture of once you left the solar system. So it's a longish update about Voyager. Let's get back to the basics, though, about Neptune. Steve, take us back, way back.
Well, there's a bit of a debate about how Neptune formed. Neptune took shape when the rest of the solar system formed about 4.5 billion years ago, when gravity pulled things such as swirling gas and dust in to become this ice giant. Now, regarding the specific location of Neptune's formation at that time, it likely occurred further away from the Sun as to where it is now. The outer regions of the protoplanetary disk, where temperatures were colder, provided a more suitable environment for the accumulation of ices and gas required for the formation of Neptune as we know it. So Neptune formed further out than where it is, and the migration of Neptune inward towards current orbit happened later in the solar system's history. But there is some debate about that. There are some astronomers who purport that it formed inside a little bit and then moved outward. And Tim, this reminds me of when I was teaching a certain science class, we had a software program that used gravitational aspects of planets and meteors, and you could change the mass of them and change their orbit and allow them to go on their own, and you could see how planets would skew other planets' orbits or smash into one another. So that was an interesting thing. Neptune, the eighth and farthest known planet from the Sun in our solar system, is believed to have formed through a process called planetary accretion. So that's where things by their own gravity sort of clump together. However, as we mentioned, there is some debate about how this actually happened. Strangely enough, Neptune is a large ice planet. We only have two of them, Uranus being the other one, four times the diameter of the Earth, though even those words are a bit off since we're talking about a planet that doesn't really have a surface. The atmosphere is made up of hydrogen, helium, and methane. And as you descend through the gaseous layers, those gaseous layers, because of gravity, form into a liquid before reaching a rocky core that is in itself about only the mass of the Earth.
So when you describe a planet that is icy blue and incredibly distant from the Sun, it seems logical that it formed as a planet a very long distance from the heat of the Sun.
I know, don't shoot me, I'm just the messenger trying to understand about these planetary formations. So the materials that would be necessary to form a planet the size of Neptune were only thought to exist much closer to the Sun, inside the current orbits of Jupiter and Saturn. It's thought that Neptune's migration to its current position was triggered by gravitational interactions with some other large objects in the early solar system, such as Jupiter and Saturn. And as we now currently know, our own moon was formed by a large subplanetary object hitting the Earth and this blob separating, and which eventually became our moon. So the stability of our present solar system was not present during its early formation.
That's a lot to absorb, Steve. Neptune used to be in the hood, but somehow it finds itself at the furthest reaches of our solar system, and we're not entirely sure why or if that's so.
I don't know about you, Tim. I really don't think much about the outer planets, such as Uranus and Neptune. Jupiter, yes. Saturn, yes. But when it comes to Uranus and Neptune, I sort of say, oh yeah, those other two.
I agree. I think I can't recall anyone ever saying, Neptune's visible tonight, or I've got a telescope aimed at Neptune, why don't you come over and have a look at it? It's too far away to be real to us.
Right, and if you did look at them through a telescope, and you'd have to have a pretty good telescope, two things would be come to mind, first of all. One, you're just going to see a point. You're not going to see a disk. And the other thing is, in the field of vision of the telescope, let's say that you finally focus it and center it, within a few moments, you're going to see it skidding out to the side, so you have to keep moving your telescope. and you'll find that you can't do that manually. You have to have a motor drive to do that kind of thing. And then if you're interested in that sort of thing, then you're really going to get interested in astronomy.
You know, I recall not long after the Voyager 2 spacecraft left Neptune, thinking perhaps another year or two, they turned the spacecraft around. They advertised this widely, and I remember staying home to watch this on my TV. They said that what they were going to do is broadcast live a family photo shot of the solar system taken as Voyager 2 was leaving the solar system, in a sense promising that you'd be able to see all of the planets and the sun. And the image was black and white. It was incredibly grainy. And I stared at that screen for perhaps an hour and never saw anything to distinguish from between the grainy dots on my television screen and the planets that I was hoping to see. And yet, I still felt like it was a special moment that I was lucky to be alive at a point in time when this was conceivably happening and right there on my TV screen.
And for conspiracy theorists, they could just as easily say it was done in the studio. You were looking at background static, and we pulled one over on you.
Maybe that's so, but I still remember it as special.
Well, of course it was special. The other interesting thing about looking up at the stars and such is the fact about when you're on the surface of the moon, for example, and you've seen the pictures of Armstrong and Scott and Aldrin, you don't see any stars in the background. And yet we're here on the Earth, and we look up on a clear night, we see a ton of stars.
Why is that?
Got to do because of how bright things are. There's the sun, or the moon has a tremendous amount of reflectivity from the our own sun, and our eyes just can't see those little tiny pinpoints of light. And yet they're there, sort of like the stars are above our heads right now in daylight. Try to convince a group of grade eighters that the stars are there right now, just go have a look. And they go, no, they come out at night.
And way up there, dark as all get out, except if you have the right telescope, is Neptune.
Now, Tim, you asked me to take us way back in time to learn a bit about the formation of the planet, and that turned out to be a bit of a surprise in terms of relocation some 4 billion years ago. Who knew about that? Why don't you move us along to the present point in time when the planet was actually discovered?
Well, things happened fast, Steve, and that was fast in 1846. The discovery of Neptune was itself one of the most important moments in astronomy and physics. A fellow named Urbain Le Verrier was a French mathematician who had been tracking the orbit of another planet, Uranus, and to his surprise, it was not following the trajectory that would reflect Newton's laws of motion and gravity. Now, I don't know how the average mathematician would feel about finding something like that, that he might, I think, conclude that he wasn't himself actually very good with numbers, or perhaps this Newton fellow was all washed up. Instead, he suspected that some other heavenly body must be exerting an influence on the orbit of Uranus. After months of calculations, Le Verrier determined the likely position of this supposed planet, sent his predictions to astronomers who could then search for it, and two named Johann Gall and Henrique Daret, both of whom were working at the Berlin Observatory, observed this planet on September 23, 1846, less than 1 degree from the predicted position. And by fast, 17 days later, those same two astronomers detected the largest of Neptune's moons, Triton. Turned out, much later, that Triton would prove to be the only moon in our solar system that does not orbit its planet in the same direction as the rotation of the host planet. The thinking being that Triton must have been out there on its own and then captured by Neptune's gravitational pull.
Wow, a couple of things really struck me there. So let's say Jupiter, we're talking about Jupiter, all of its moons rotate, let's say, clockwise. And all of the planets and their moons rotate in the same way that the planet rotates. But on Neptune, they're all rotating one way, but this one moon, Triton, goes the other way? That's absurd.
It's curious. Now, Steve, people sometimes accuse me of having an odd way of looking at things, and I think this might be one of those times, so bear with me. You'd agree that we don't have a perfectly clear picture of what life was like in 1846, when this mathematician in France was following the orbit of the planet Uranus.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so stay with me. So we know that in that year, flush toilets didn't become prevalent for much longer until the late 19th century.
Flush toilets. Okay, Tim, this is a show about space, a science-based program.
I see you're staying with me. That's good. True. All true. Here's the thing. Just how incredible does it seem, getting on for 200 years later in time, that we're talking about this one mathematician from France and a couple of astronomers from another country using whatever that was used back in those days for calculations, a telescope, and some head-turning ideas from a guy who'd lived in the 17th century, and yet they discovered the planet Neptune and most of its moons despite living in societies that didn't have flush toilets.
That mathematician, Urbain Le Verrier, did get his reward for that brilliant piece of work, by the way, though. When the astronomer Galley was able to observe the planet, he initially proposed several names, including Janus, Oceanus, and, yes, an honorific Le Verrier in honor of the man who had predicted its existence. However, Le Verrier ultimately suggested the name Neptune. What an honorable man. After the Roman god of the sea, and that name was chosen because of the planet's blue color, and because the discovery of a new planet was seen as a major event in the exploration of the solar system, much like the discovery of new lands by seafarers. So, while Le Verrier did not officially name the planet himself, he did suggest the name that was ultimately chosen and has been used ever since.
So Neptune, I think, does have a ring to it, Steve. Now, I'm not sure how we'd feel had the planet been named Le Verrier. And I can imagine it wouldn't have gone over very well with viewers of the Fox News Channel. So the key here, seriously though, is that the planet's bluish color is very much related to the name of the planet and how it has been perceived ever since. Now, just how blue is it? Turns out quite a bit. Although Voyager 2 did record some amazing photographs of Neptune, the space telescope Hubble has published even more dramatic images of the planet and its blue character, and of course these are all readily available online.
This remarkable blue is the result of the planet's atmosphere, and in particular, the high levels of methane gas. So the atmosphere of Neptune is composed mostly of hydrogen and helium, but it does contain a small amount of methane, which is responsible for the planet's blue appearance. The methane absorbs red light, which is the longest wavelength in the visible spectrum, and reflects blue light, which is the shortest wavelength.
It's kind of odd, you know. Here on Earth, methane gas gets a bad rap, and it certainly seems to be a concern when we're talking about the effect of methane on global warming. So, Steve, I was curious about the relative volume of methane in the atmosphere of the two planets. We've got enough methane in our atmosphere to impact our climate. We know that. But in actual fact, it's just a tiny, tiny percent of the atmosphere in total, most of which on Earth is made up of either hydrogen or oxygen. It turns out methane comprises just 0.00017% of our atmosphere. Not the same thing on Neptune. There, 15%.
Wow. Well, we mentioned the largest moon circling Neptune earlier, Triton. Presumably it doesn't have its own atmosphere, but it's certainly the same distance from the sun. Does all that methane in the Neptune atmosphere make that planet a whole lot warmer than Triton?
So we're saying, is there global warming on Neptune? Well, bit of a surprise yet again. At least it was a surprise for me. The relative volume of methane in the atmosphere of Neptune is not the main reason for the relatively warm temperatures compared to Triton. The temperatures on Neptune are indeed warmer than Triton, with an average temperature of around minus 200 C. However, temperatures reach up to minus 130 at the cloud tops, and this is due to the heat generated by Neptune's internal processes, which cause the planet to emit more heat than it receives from the sun. Rather interesting, I thought. On the other hand, Triton has an average surface temperature of about minus 235. Triton's colder temperatures are due to its distance from the sun, as well as its lack of internal heat sources. Unlike Neptune, Triton does not have significant internal heat sources to help keep the place warm. So while the methane in the atmosphere of Neptune does contribute to the planet's overall climate and weather patterns, it is not, in fact, the main reason for its relatively warm temperatures.
Now, interestingly, you mentioned there, Tim, about the internal heat of a planet. And we have a similar thing on Earth, where the core of our Earth is very, very hot, which is why miners, particularly gold miners, find temperatures are extremely hot as you go further and further toward the center. But before we leave the moon Triton altogether, it does seem to be quite the anomaly when it comes to moons orbiting planets in our solar system. As mentioned earlier, it's the only one to orbit its host planet in the opposite direction, and that's called a retrograde orbit.
Steve, there are some other items of note about Triton that I thought we might mention. Geysers, for example. Triton is one of the few moons in our solar system that has active geysers, and these spew nitrogen gas and dust particles into the atmosphere to a height of up to 8 kilometers.
And I noted that with regard to atmosphere, Triton has a thin atmosphere composed mainly of nitrogen with small amounts of methane and carbon monoxide. And this is unusual for a moon of its size, as most moons with a similar size and mass don't have any significant atmospheres.
There's such a thing as chirovolcanism, Steve, and Triton is thought to have these on its surface. They're volcanoes that erupt a mixture of water, ammonia, and other volatiles instead of molten rock. Chirovolcanic activity on Triton is believed to be the source of the nitrogen that makes up its thin atmosphere.
And with regard to surface features, Triton is covered in a variety of unusual features, including ridges, valleys, and plains, as well as impact craters and fissures. Some of these features suggest that Triton may have had a more geologically active past, which has since slowed down.
Almost like it was at one point one of those rogue planets we've talked about previously before it was captured by the gravity of Neptune. I think that's quite enough science, though, for one episode of Space Talks. Neptune is a very long way from Earth. It's blue and it's cold, and it takes a very long time to get there. And given those basics, a lot of what comes to mind when the name comes up, Neptune, well, it's based on our imagination, not our calculators, not our telescopes. Steve, you're the cultured one.
Tim, I spell culture with a K. Things are relative. First of all, Neptune gets its name after the Roman god of the sea, so that tends to drive a great deal of perceptions and imagination of what the planet Neptune is about. That said, with regard to literature, Neptune has been referenced in many works of literature, including William Shakespeare's The Tempest. And the planet was also mentioned in Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, where Captain Nemo's submarine, the Nautilus, travels to the Neptune of the Atlantic Ocean.
How about in the art world? Neptune has been a popular subject in visual arts, from classical paintings to modern graphic art. The planet is often depicted as a blue orb with swirling white clouds surrounded by rings and its many moons.
And we've referred to music and Gustav Holst's The Planet Suite, and the final movement, Neptune the Mystic, is a haunting and ethereal piece that Holst scored for an offstage female choir, adding to the otherworldly quality of the music.
You know, I'm going to throw this in, even though it's astrology. In astrology, Neptune is associated with spiritual and psychic matters, I guess tied into that mystic quality.
And I'm getting this sense that we're at the end of this episode. Would that be correct?
You are correct, sir. I'm feeling it too. Well, that's it for our look at Neptune on this episode of Space Talks. And until next time, this is Tim Woods here in Salmon Arm.
And Stephen Lowry, also in Salmon Arm, bidding you all adieu. And we'll see you next time on Space Talks.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see.